This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Callie Crossley. Today there are close to 300,000 women actively serving in the military, though many of them are doing the same jobs as men and facing the same risks as men. They are excluded from combat. Joining me to explain why these combat exclusions are so significant is Juliette Kayyem. She's the national security and foreign policy columnist for the Boston Globe and a lecturer in public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Juliette Kayyem, welcome back.
Thank you very much for having me.
Let's set the context for this because there was long a ban against women being in combat, but something changed after 2011.
Right. So there's the way to describe it is there was a traditional ban of essentially women in the military serving in any sort of combat-like roles. And over the course of 30 or 40 years, there's been loosening of these rules. But the overall rule that women cannot be in combat, so I put that in quotes, still stands. And most recently in 2011, the Pentagon let loose on some rules. So they opened up another 14,000 jobs that had been women had been prohibited from.
That was in February?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And they had done that based on an internal review. But if you just sort of take a step backwards and you say, how are women being utilized in the wars? Essentially, they are in combat. And the military uses them in combat. And they get around this combat exclusion rule by saying women are assigned to combat, to all male combat teams, but they're not a part of them. So it's all sort of this legal mumbo jumbo. The most important thing to remember is over 100 women have died since 9/11 in the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. They're serving in all sorts of roles. And the Pentagon has had an opportunity to look at the rules and to look at itself and to take the advice of their own internal commission and just end the combat exclusion rules, just end them and figure out ways in which women are integrated.
Well, let me stop you there and ask the question, why was there? Because if you're listening to this, as I was coming into it through your column about it, you know, why was there a ban to begin with?
So some of it was the traditional, you know, just sort of gender roles. Some of it was on troop cohesion and what men need to do in terms of wars in which there's battlefields. We don't have those wars much anymore. A third reason was just the physical aptitude of women, which I'm willing to grant as a whole. Most women will not satisfy the sort of strict requirements of, say, the Marines or some covert operations. But the Pentagon sort of wouldn't budge enough. And so what happened most recently, and I've been writing on this for over a year in a variety of different columns, is a bunch of women, four women, finally said, we've given you 11 years since the wars began, and they haven't budged, and so they sued. And so now the Pentagon is in a very different position, which is it's going to have to go into court and defend the last known vestige, the last vestige, it's not even known, of gender discrimination by a federal government entity. My argument in my most recent column, once they filed this lawsuit, was, you know, do we really want to go there? And does this administration want to go there? Mm-hmm. I mean, really, the Pentagon is going to be much better off lifting the combat exclusion rules, figuring out ways in which women are fully integrated, giving them the opportunities that they need, and doing it in a way in which the Pentagon can't control it, rather than a long-term litigation in which you have these semi-perfect plaintiffs. They fought in Iraq and Afghanistan. One won the Purple Heart. They've been wounded. It's a big fight. I know there's been a lot of focus on gay marriage, that going to the Supreme Court. If the Pentagon chooses to fight this and to demand their combat exclusion rules maintained, this will be the next big civil rights one.
All right. Well, let's parse some of what you've said, which is a lot of information. And also just let me highlight a couple of things.
Yeah.
Again, the 300,000 women have served in Iraq and Afghanistan. 14% of the 1.4 million active military personnel been in the war. That's women.
Yeah.
There was the ban, but after 9/11, a lot of stuff changed. They adapted the rules in 1994 and then again in February opened up more positions. And I want to bring Viviana Cordoba into the conversation. She's the program coordinator for the Massachusetts Department of Veterans Services Women Veterans Network. In 2005, you were, Viviana, deployed as a part of a medical unit to Iraq, so you know very much about the Iraq experience.
Yes, having lived it, firsthand experience, watching these women come into the clinic with advanced armor, advanced weaponry, seeking assistance, and just like their male counterparts were, I quickly learned to realize that it's very different what the media is projecting back home than what's going on overseas.
So would you say in your experience, you know, what was the percent? Was it half and half, one third, whatever, of women that you saw who clearly had been on the front lines?
A good third of it were women veterans serving and seeking services. They were gunners. They were fighter pilots. Even going back in history, these things weren't they weren't known in society, but they were going on in even in the American Revolution, even though women were disguised as men, unfortunately. And now we have the benefit of not having to do that. But this is what's going on. This is the role of women on the modern battlefield, and society still doesn't really have a good grasp as to the role of women serving now.
So, Viviana, did you hear when you were in Iraq, women saying, you know, gee, this is crazy. I'm doing this work. I don't know why I can't get recognized for it. Was there any conversation about that?
You know, it's the conversations we've had overseas were more along the lines of the military culture always teaches you to seldom seek resources, especially as a woman, where you have to compete mentally and physically with men.
Just suck it up and do the job.
Right. So I don't want to hear that you left your newborn at home and that your husband wants to divorce. you deal with that when you get home. So, and then when they come back, they're telling me, you know, I did the same thing as the men. I was living in these bunkers. I was doing the same things. And when I come home, you know, someone stops me on the street and say, "Oh, your sweatshirt says Marine. Was your dad in? Was your brother in?" And that hurts. It's a big blow, especially when you're out there doing the same things and you're coming home to a country that really doesn't want to know.
That's my guest, Viviana Cordoba. She is the program coordinator for the Massachusetts Department of Veterans Services, Women's Veterans Network. And in 2005, she was deployed as part of a medical unit in Iraq. I'm also speaking with Juliette Kayyem, who is a national security and foreign policy columnist for the Boston Globe and a lecturer in public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. And we're talking about these peculiar rules around combat for women who are, in fact, in combat, but can't say they've been in combat, to the point now that a couple of organizations have filed suit. The ACLU has sued the Veterans Affairs and Department of Defense, another group has filed suit saying you got to recognize women as having served in combat, not just having served. So what will it mean if that happens? And why? What are they trying to get as a result of the lawsuit other than recognition for it?
Okay, so they're trying to get, in the technical legal terms, you know, injunctive relief, which is essentially to have the Pentagon change the rules. And the reason why they're doing this, and I read the complaint and talked to people involved with the case, essentially, their opportunities are limited because of the combat exclusion rule. Mm-hmm. And that is, I mean, you can see that in just the numbers coming out of the Pentagon. If you look at promotion rates and what they call flagged officers, that's sort of generals and higher, you know, the percentages are lower than the percentages of women in the military. They are denied certain training because some training is linked to combat roles, and some other things that they're sort of denied because of the combat exclusion rule. So what they're essentially saying is our time in the military was hurt, you know, in terms of their experience, their opportunities, their rights to promotion. And so therefore we've been harmed, and therefore the Pentagon has to end these rules. And I'll tell you just one anecdote from the column that I wrote, because I got interested in this and picking up on Viviana when I learned that over 140 women had died in the wars. And I had never heard that. I mean, that to me was, you know, I had this notion that women were, you know, running, you know, were doing medical stuff and whatever else. But the idea that 140 plus women have died in these wars is just never acknowledged. And I wrote this column about the litigation and saying, you know, the Pentagon has an opportunity to end the combat exclusion rule, do what it did with Don't Ask, Don't Tell, make the reforms necessary. No one will be talking about it 10 days from now. You know what I mean? In other words, it's like, don't ask, don't tell. Like, it's, you know, the sky does not fall. And I got scores of emails from what I then dubbed the combat dads. The military is a family business, and a lot of combat dads or dads emailed me and they said, you know, right on, I have a daughter in the military. I don't know how to explain to her that I want her to commit to the military, but and yet there's this exclusion. And so, you know, like soccer dads who watch their daughters perform and go to the Olympics, I call them the combat dads. There's a huge sentiment within the military that this that is so antiquated. And it's so antiquated both legally, but also just the types of, wars we fight. There's not, you know, this is not World War II anymore. We've got essentially, you know, urban warfare. We've got counterinsurgency. And if we want to get the best and the brightest to be committed, we should have all opportunities available to them.
I wanted to point out some of the women who are a part of the lawsuit because, you know, in case people have in their minds sort of the stereotype of what you think a woman is doing in the war. Here are some of the plaintiffs. Major Mary Jennings Hager, a helicopter rescue pilot with the Air National Guard who was shot down in Afghanistan in 2009 while rescuing three injured soldiers. Army Staff Sergeant Jennifer Hunt, who patrolled with soldiers on combat missions in Afghanistan and Iraq. And Marine First Lieutenant Colleen Farrell, who was also an FET leader in Afghanistan. Hagar and Hunt were both awarded the Purple Heart for being wounded in action. So it's clear that's combat. That's just not fighting. That's combat. Right, Viviana?
That's correct. And even going to the example of the first Silver Star recipient, Leon Hastings, she led her entire team through a kill zone, ended up killing over 30 insurgents by herself. Well, not by herself, with herself and her team leader. And her team leader grabbed her. He didn't grab another male because he knew that she wouldn't buckle under pressure and she was an excellent she shot very well. These are the type of things that are going on now.
So when you think about a promotion that a woman can't get now, even if they've done all this, you know, incredible work under pressure, as you've said, in combat, what are the kinds of things that they're not being able to get to? I guess it goes without saying, can't be a four-star general, right?
That's probably, I mean, they're going to, the Pentagon has said, no, combat is not a requirement to become a four-star general. But you just look at the numbers and something, you know, there may be unstated requirements and that include combat. So 14% of the military is women, but only 7%, I just grabbed these numbers, only 7% are flagged officers. So you're it's not 14% is small, but then when you get to the flagged officers, it's half of the women's representation in the pool. So clearly the training, the access to education, and then, of course, the combat are all sort of integrated, and they're all sort of how women are evaluated. And if they aren't given those opportunities, they can get the awards, the Purple Heart and others. But you just look at the numbers and it's hard. And I think that's what's going to happen in litigation. It's hard to say that it's hard to defend that with a straight face. I mean, it's clearly something's going on in the Pentagon that you're having so few women being flagged officers. And there's an unstated combat rule.
Well, here's something that I didn't know that I thought was very interesting that I think should be articulated for people who are learning this as I was, that all units that go to Iraq and Afghanistan, even if you're not a combat unit, in quotes, are exposed to combat.
Yes.
So it's a great example here that women are routinely assigned to military police units. But if you go to Iraq to provide security and training, well, all of us have seen the scenes of the guys going through in those houses trying to make sure, you know, there's no insurgents in there. Well, those are women in there, too.
Yes.
So you're in combat whether or not you signed up for it strictly or not, Viviana.
Yeah, it's the fine print that you all joke about. Even in the documentary Lioness that we sometimes host at the network, there were five women, and some of them were cooks, engineers. They weren't in an infantry role initially, and they were placed with a Marine team in Fallujah, 2003, the largest counterinsurgency mission in the Iraq campaign, and they did well. And Nowhere in history were they listed there. No, in the paperwork, women weren't on there. It never happened.
So what do you do then with the Women's Veterans Network here in Massachusetts, Viviana? Is there any way that that organization can support these women in their effort to get recognized? Or are you just trying to make sure they get the services, the regular services that are that are accrued to them because they have been veterans?
Yes, we're basically a central resource for women veterans that come back from these deployments so that they can know that when they call, they're not just going to get a 50-year-old male that has never served trying to understand where they've been. They're going to talk to a combat woman veteran, understands what they've been through, knows the system, knows the resources, can advocate on their behalf. We hold several events throughout the year, including the Women Veterans Conference. And Women Veteran Appreciation Day in November at the State House, including documentary screenings that show the difficulties that women face after a deployment as well. So it's important for us to get the word out and to let women know that, yes, we are the minority, but we're the fastest growing segment in today's military. And these conversations about whether or not we can serve in the front lines on paper or not are going to be in the past one day. Mm-hmm. And we're growing. And there's other women, especially in Massachusetts, where there's over 27,000 women veterans, that we're all here to help each other.
I think that is so well stated in the sense that if you just look forward, and this was sort of, you know, the Pentagon can be cautious and conservative for all the right reasons too. But, you know, just looking forward, this is going to change. We know it's going to change. Mm-hmm. You just can't look at the nature
Absolutely.
Of the warfares, the women coming back, what they do, and think that this rule can stand. And so part of what the lawsuit will do, hopefully, is to get more people engaged in this issue to say, wait a second, just because it's been around for 200 years doesn't mean that we have to live by it now. And I think, you know, the military has a lot of gender problems. I mean, we know this by who's coming back. It's got sexual abuse problems. It's got all sorts.
Yes, if I can interrupt you, I would be remiss if I didn't note that I've seen some really powerful documentaries about the level of sexual assault that women soldiers have had to undergo. And they're not getting relief when they complain from the military.
And so one way to look at that, if you're a certain type of person, is to say, well, that's what happens when you integrate women. But, you know, I think it's safe to say that these other problems that the military has, the other gender problems, are because of a culture that I believe that treats women as second-class citizens in terms of their roles, even though reality is they're in the front lines. And so the Pentagon might – who knows? But the Pentagon might experience – fewer of these other systemic gender problems if it would begin to elevate women and give them the opportunities that they deserve and that everyone knows is already happening. I mean, so it seems unsustainable, and the lawsuit will probably reach a point in which hopefully the Pentagon and this administration, I mean, it's the Obama administration, will have to say, it's just, you know, let's end the ban and figure out how to do this in the right way under our own a timeline rather than being forced by a lower court, let alone the Supreme Court.
So how much external pressure do you think the fact that Don't Ask, Don't Tell is gone will bring to this lawsuit and move this to the front burner?
It's the next big issue. It has not gotten the same sort of outside support. And I think part of what, you know, like what the state's doing, Viviana and others, is just sort of say, look, this is a huge population of people that we need to give voice to. I think the litigation is going to help to, you know, they don't have a Lady Gaga yet, you know, sort of forcing this issue. But I think the Don't Ask, Don't Tell is important because, you know, as I said, the sky did not fall. Gays are serving openly in the military, and from the looks of it, everyone survived. And I think if you can just have that attitude that our military has gone through a lot of changes and this will be another one that reflects the society that we're in, you know, it will all be fine. And so the Don't Ask, Don't Tell example is sort of perfect in that regard. Mm-hmm. But it is true. This does not have the bells and whistles that that the Don't Ask, Don't Tell movement did. And hopefully it will get that.
What do you think about that? The external pressure of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, Viviana? Do you think it'll also wake some people up who might not have thought about this.
Absolutely. I think that lifting that ban in itself was long overdue. But within the military, from my own experience, because we also served with gay soldiers, it doesn't exist. We know of it, and that's our battle buddy, regardless of what gender they prefer. So I think that taboo and that sort of pressure just pretty much mostly comes from society. Once you're in the military, as long as they have your back, it really doesn't matter when the stuff hits the fan.
All right. Well, that's well said. And hopefully we'll see some changes made. At this, I'll be back to you, Juliet, when the ruling comes down.
Yeah.
I've been talking with Juliet Kayyem and Viviana Cordoba. Juliet Kayyem is the National Security and Foreign Policy columnist for the Boston Globe and a lecturer in public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Viviana Cordoba is the program coordinator for the Massachusetts Department of Veteran Services Women's Veterans Network. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Thanks for joining us. The conversation never ends online at WGBHnews.org. Boston Public Radio is a production of WGBH. I'm Callie Crossley. Have a great afternoon.